Our agenda this morning with Senator Peterson, Senate File 2224.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members.
Good morning, Senator Peterson.
We have before you this morning Senate File 2224, which is largely an unemployment insurance bill. I need to first offer the A-12 amendment.
Senator Peterson is... It's in the packet, and Senator Newman would like to make that motion before we vote on it. Could you explain it, please?
Sure. Madam Chair, the amendment primarily deals specifically with a definition. You'll see in the bill that there's a definition that we need to clarify for the word pattern in relating to how an employer may fail to provide information to the department on an applicant's separation from their organization. It also treats, there's a change there to address concerns from larger employers. It basically changed, you'll see in the amendment, it changes employers that have a higher level of claims, such as temporary employment agencies. It changes the item to a percentage rather than a specific number of claims, which we believe is more fair and the agency has agreed to as well.
Are there any questions about the A-12-0778 amendment? If not, all in favor of Senator Newman's motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill is the result of the work of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, which is made up of both business and labor groups, including some legislative members, including myself, Senator Ted Daley, Senator Tomasoni, and Senator Kelash, who you all know. All of these senators are authors on this bill, so you can see that I think there's a broad base of bipartisan support. And I think because, as I mentioned, it's largely I would call it a technical bill and an agency bill to just make some corrections. One of the major corrections you'll see there primarily is to get the state of Minnesota in compliance with the federal government. There was a change last summer will allow – we need to make the change just simply so that Minnesota employers will continue to get federal credits through the unemployment system in the tune of about $750 million. The other major change – is that it puts the penalty money that employers might experience into the trust fund, which pays out unemployment rather than currently it goes into the administrative costs right now. And so I think we're all more comfortable with that, so that the penalties are going into pay down rates or pay down benefits rather than pay for state staff and that type of thing. It seems more appropriate. That was the major change. I certainly would entertain any questions folks might have relating to this topic.
I see we have some people who have signed up to testify. Did they want to come forward at this time too? Lee Nelson and Richard Calgiara. Gary?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rick Calagiri. I'm Director of Unemployment Insurance, the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And we're here primarily to answer any questions, if the chair and the committee has any questions.
Members, we have a fiscal note in our packet as well that you may want to review. It is indicating some savings. Does anyone want to address that in particular?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the overall effect of these changes would be a positive impact. It doesn't impact the general fund at all. This is the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. And among the many changes that are being implemented this year, there's one where we're going to be recapturing overpayments fraud and non-fraud overpayments using federal income tax recapture. And so there will be a overall net savings to the UI trust funds as a result of this. There are some other provisions that have been implemented by the federal government relative to recapturing overpayments as well, going directly to the trust fund too. So we're making these changes to be in compliance with the federal law.
Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just speaking of the fund, how is the balance in the fund now?
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, we will be coming out of debt in Minnesota permanently this summer. So this is much sooner than many other states, so that businesses ultimately with their FUTA tax credits next year will go back to normal tax credits. This has been a rapid recovery from debt as compared to, for example, our neighbor state, Wisconsin. They will be in debt to the federal government for another 2 or 3 years.
Good time to retire, Madam Chair.
Senator Vana.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nelson, that's wonderful news. I was on, you know, the commission a couple years ago, and we hadn't projected that it was going to come out this quickly. So that's great work and really a credit to the staff because, you know, when I was on the commission, I was so impressed with the way that this has been managed for many years.
Senator Stump, did you have a question too?
Madam Chair, yes, I did. Thank you. Could you give us just an idea as to how many people in Minnesota are unemployed and the amount of money that goes out to those in terms of unemployment compensation?
Mr. Caligiuri?
Madam Chair, Senator Stump, I think we paid out in a combination of both state and federal funds in the year 2010 about $1.8 billion. In the prior year, it was $2.8 billion in benefits coming out of the recession. So it's been dropping dramatically along with our unemployment rate. This year, during the peak of our unemployment season, which, again, Minnesota is a very seasonal state, and our unemployment peaks at about the end of the year or the beginning of the year with construction, recreation industries, et cetera. We had about 130,000 people on unemployment. There are more people unemployed, the overall number of people who are unemployed. This is just the number of people who qualify for and are on unemployment insurance. But it peaked this year at about 130,000. I think during the recession, Lee, I'm not sure, it was well over 200,000 people, like 240,000 people during the peak of the recession that were drawing unemployment insurance.
Mr. Caligiuri, how many people fully used their benefits that they simply ran out at some point?
Madam Chair, committee members, if you're asking how many people exhaust, absolutely exhaust all benefits. Again, remember there are state benefits and then there's federal extended benefits that are have been available during the recession, which are starting to trigger off. There was both the Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program, which has three tiers to it. You go from one tier to the next after your standard unemployment. And then there was an extended benefits program as well. We triggered off the extended benefits program, and the trigger is your state's unemployment rate. And so we triggered off that extended benefits program a few months ago. We are right now triggering off Tier 1 of the Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program right now. We're going to trigger off the second tier of that in May, again, as our unemployment rate declines. So these programs that were put in place that are basically to respond to the economy and during the recession, they're intended to trigger off during recovery, and we're in that process right now. I think that currently we have about 16,000 people that are beyond that standard unemployment and on those federal extended programs right now, and that number will then be rapidly decreasing.
popular. Are there any other questions? Is there a motion? Senator Perry? Senator Perry moves then. Well, is there anyone in the audience that wanted to testify for or against the bill? Okay, on Senator Perry's motion that Senate File 2224 be recommended to pass as amended and sent placed on general orders, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders. Thank you, Senator Peterson. Next up, we have Senator Ingebertson, who's going to present Senate File 2493 related to the Outdoor Heritage Fund.
Morning, Madam Chair and members.
Good morning.
I have with me today Bill Becker, the Executive Director of the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. Senate File 2493 is the annual legacy bill that comes forward. Let me explain a little bit. The legacy dollars are generally come in biennial. This is the only portion of the legacy money that comes annually. So that's what we're here with before you today. The bottom line is there's an appropriation of about $99. And I think you have it in your packet, and I should talk about that. We do have a little short description of the bill in front of you that includes the areas of expenditures for the prairies, forests, wetlands, and habitat, as well as some administration costs. But the bottom line is about almost $100 million this year is going out to the projects that are listed. As you all recall, in 2008, the legacy funding, 3/8 of 1% of sales tax, was on the voter referendum. It was voted in 2008, and since then, we've been able to put significant dollars because of the will of the folks into many different projects, not only outdoor projects, but as you know, the Clean Water Council, the Clean Water Projects. Receives one-third of the portion of funding, and the arts, humanities, and parks split the third one-third of the funds. We adopted once again the recommendations of the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. That's a council that comes together monthly and bimonthly throughout the year, I sit on that council along with Senator Saxog in the Senate, and we go through the proposals that come forward. And those proposals, members and Madam Chair, can be I think over the past 4 years, anywhere between $200 to $400 million worth of proposals, worth of projects that have come before yearly. And once again, we have the $99 million. Now it's a note of interest that I believe the first bill that came out was, and Bill can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was in the high 50s or low $60 million. So it's obviously with the economy rebounding and over the past 4 years, there's more money coming into the fund. So it's very significant, actually. But we've always went with the recommendation of the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, a group of excellent practitioners that really know their business, and we meet again monthly to go through the process and come up with the best programs, or at least by way of we do actually have a system that we do some grading and very rigorous, actually, and we come up with the bill. And this year, of course, I believe even with three different votes, we voted 12-0 to bring the bill forward as you see it. So also included, you will see, one of the highlights, let me talk about one of the highlights. We always have one project that seems to take the most conversation, and that's the Northwoods Habitat Complex, which basically we're purchasing approximately 2,000 acres along the Mississippi north and east of Brainerd. And with a public, state-county partnership, that The proposal states that we will actually turn those properties over to the county of Crow Wing, and Crow Wing would actually do the management, and of course they would also take on the PILT obligation. So it's a real win-win situation for all of Minnesotans. It'll be 2,000 acres. It'll be set aside forever that all Minnesotans can come along and enjoy. Also included in the bill with regards to that is eventually they're talking about connecting the trails system through this particular property. And if and when that is done, due to the fact that we don't, through the Lasard Sams, appropriate money for trails, the trails portion of the legacy money would actually, or someone else, it might be the DNR, who might pay for that trail, that money would come back into the bottom line on this particular, on Lasard Sams. So if and when that trail is actually built, those dollars would come back, and that's addressed in this bill. So it's a real, you know, it's certainly a good, again, partner, project partnering up with another entity that's willing to take this project on. And again, we won't have a PILT obligation, or we won't have to do the actual expenditure in managing that 2,000 acres. Also included is a $5.5 million in this bill for Asian carp barriers. The committee went through a lot of discussion, obviously, to protect and enhance and restore habitat. We thought it fit the Constitution's definition of expenditure, so we decided to spend $5.5 million. Now, you should know that there's all kinds of different funds that are floating around in bills that are going to be utilized for carp barriers as well as University of Minnesota research. But this Lasard in this particular bill actually donates expends $5.5 million towards that effort.
Senator Ingebertson, as long as we're on that topic, how much is anticipated to be the need for that in total?
You know, Madam Chair, we actually have a meeting today, I believe it's today or tomorrow, with the governor's office, myself and my counterpart in the House are going to meet with the administration because, as you know, the governor's had three different summits throughout the summer on this very issue.
With Will, too.
And there's dollars that are being requested through the bonding. There's dollars that are being requested from different areas. It's just how we put the bill together. I'd only be guessing if I were to give you a figure. I think the lock and dam system, if we do barriers, again, it's only going to be a guess, but I think we're upwards of, with all three of the locks and dams, it would be in that $15 to $20 million category. And about $4 million to, and again in that ballpark for University of Minnesota research, we felt the need, or I think at least everybody coming together is feeling the need to continue the research that Dr. Sorensen's been doing for years on common carp and expand into the big head. Invasive carp that's coming up the river. So we're looking at some one-time dollars of, and we already have, as you know, last year in the bonding bill spent $16 million on the Coon Rapids Dam. So by the time we get done, it's going to be upwards of $40 million of one-time money.
Thank you, Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, can you talk a little bit about the invasive species beyond just the Asian carp? I see that we're funding the University of Minnesota Center, but in terms of actual money going towards fighting things like the zebra mussels and then also some of the other things as, you know, milfoil, that sort of thing, it doesn't appear that that's singled out in the bill. Is that in some other bill traveling?
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Madam Chair and Senator, yes, it is. Obviously, that isn't the only invasive that we're worried about. Is the carp. It's the zebra and the quagga mussel, as well as the milfoil and the curly leaf pondweed. All of that research that needs to be done is being addressed in other bills. In the Game and Fish bill, we address that. We beef up, and I think I'll be here. I think I'll be here Thursday or Friday with that bill, and you'll see there how we actually beef up the enforcement for the zebra mussel transportation of zebra mussels and. But yes, all the areas are being covered, and we think it's important, obviously, because the expansion of all these invasives into our lake is going to really certainly hurt our, you know, what Minnesota is all about, and that's fishing, recreation, and opportunities such as that, which is, you know, a huge part of our economy. So.
Madam Senator Chair, Bonner. And I understand that there has been, you know, quite a bit reserved for the research part of it, and so I'm pleased to hear you also talk about enforcement. I think that the public that I hear from, you know, I represent Medicine Lake, and then I know Senator Olson has most of Lake Minnetonka. I have a little bit, but people feel so strongly that they want to go far beyond research at this point, that they want aggressive action. And I know there's been some kind of a controversy as to how much of the clean water money could go towards that. But I, for one, think that that is about clean water. Sure. And so I would hope that we always include that as we weigh how to spend our resources.
Right. And also included, I'm sorry.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair and Senator, included in the next portion of the bill that I was going to talk about is clean water funding. That's some money that came back to the bottom line. There's going to be nearly $6 million of clean water money that's actually going to be put towards this as well. So that the bill addresses that.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, the rest of it would be parks and trails. The only difference you'll see there, of course, that appropriation went out in the biennium budget. This particular bill eliminates the cap and match for local grants for parks and trails. Currently, there is a $500,000 cap on grants, as well as a 25% match requirement from the local units of government. We also extend funds appropriated to the Met Council Regional Park System in fiscal year 2011, and that was actually for 2011 and made the funds available through June of 2013. That is because the funds that were appropriated to the Metro Regional Parks System was not spent, and we just give them permission to go ahead and spend that money as it was appropriated. They do have a plan that's coming forth real soon where they will actually show that those dollars will be expended. So,
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, just a point of clarification, Senator Ingebrigtsen, on the handout sheet that you have that has Article 4 Environment Natural Resources Fund. I haven't looked at the bill it said, but is that LCCMR monies, or is this all legacy monies?
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
The Environmental Trust Fund is LCCMR, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Also, we have a handout, if we could, Madam. Oh, it's in the packet.
Yeah.
Okay, it's in the packet, the colored handout that shows you where the expenditures are going and has over the history, which I find to be very interesting, Madam Chair and members. So I guess I don't have anything further than that, if you stand for questions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Ingebrigtsen, could you explain what the technical evaluation panel does.
And then we move it over here.
What? I think I'll turn that over to Executive Director Bill Becker, Senator Stump. What page are you on? I'm sorry.
It's on page 16 of the bill.
All right.
Mr. Becker, do you want to identify yourself for the record?
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm Bill Becker, the Executive Director of the Lesard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. The technical evaluation panels select a subset sample of the restorations and enhancements that have been funded with the Outdoor Heritage Fund and monitor to see whether they achieve their goals and give feedback as to how to improve restorations and evaluations. They're done by a Board of Water and Soil Resources and DNR group.
Okay.
Senator Stump?
I had one other question. It's more kind of an overview question for Senator Ingebrigtsen. When you look at the overall structure of how the Outdoor Heritage Fund was set up, do you think it's achieving what the intent of that fund was? And it seems like it, you know, when you listen to the explanation, and I mean, it's a it seems like it's accomplishing a lot of good projects and everything, but what's your overall assessment of it?
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Stump, thank you very much for that question. I think the report here really, really does tell the story just of exactly how many, you know, dollars have been put towards projects in the state of Minnesota that we wouldn't have had over the last 4 years. These are over and above the projects. Obviously, we cannot supplant. Now, we always get into this, you know, commingling of dollars and supplanting, but and we're very, I think we're very vigilant when it comes to that. We really monitor that, and with the help of the legislative auditor, auditor's office, who's audited us at least twice, they're saying we're doing a tremendous job through the Lasard-San Jose Heritage on keeping track of outcomes, things like that. So, I don't think anybody can argue with the amount of projects that are going out there. That was what the intention of the voter was in 2008, and I know there's some people that still don't think that that should have happened, but nevertheless, it's part of the Constitution. Minnesotans seem to, by evidence of the lottery, you know, some years ago, they seem to want to spend extra dollars on that because we have such a beautiful resource. It was interesting. We're going to be coming with the bill and later in the week with regards to looking at raising hunting, fishing, and license fees for the DNR, and we had Bud Grant testify in our committee, and the reason I asked him to testify, not only because, you know, everybody knows Bud Grant and what an outdoorsman he is, but his experience, life experiences of traveling throughout the United States as well as, you know, other parts of the world. And I said, I'd like to have you give a comparison as to what Minnesota looks like compared to everybody else. And he says this is by far the extreme jewel of outdoor hunting and fishing opportunities that he's ever experienced in his life. And that means an awful lot. It should mean an awful lot to everybody here because of his experience. So the folks have said time and again through the ballot that they want us to take care of it. And I think it's a real challenge, however, though, Senator, to make sure we stay focused on that and we don't get sidetracked with funding other different things that everybody would, you know, seem to put heritage together with different projects, for instance, the Viking stadiums and, as you know, and things like that. So, I mean, we all really need to be cognizant of that is always there. Everybody does have a right to their opinion. But it was very clear what they voted for. They voted for at least this portion of the constitutional amendment for the betterment of hunting and fishing opportunities. And I think it's done a remarkable job.
Right. Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, when they're in the prairie section, and there's quite a few projects listed here, and they add up to pretty significant dollars, are we talking about doing prairie restoration on existing state lands? Or are we purchasing lands for these? Could you give me a little better idea of what these projects are about?
Madam Chair, I think I will let
Mr. Becker,
the man that works with us on a daily basis.
Madam Chair, the answer to your question is both. There is a significant prairie restoration and enhancement program on line 4.33. That's $4.3 million to accelerate the restoration and enhancement of wildlife management areas, scientific and natural areas, and lands under native prairie bank easements, primarily prairie and grassland.
Hold the mic just a little closer to you, please.
Primarily prairie and grassland. In the same section, the prairie section of the bill, is an accelerating the wildlife management area program phase four. Line 4.11, which is $3.3 million in acquisition of land for wildlife management areas. So it's a combination of both. I would say that this is the largest recommendation the council has made for enhanced management of prairies and grasslands in the 4 years. I think that the acreage that's being addressed is nearly 100,000 acres of prairie and grassland enhanced and restored. So I think that the council can be proud of what it's doing in that area.
Mr. Ricker, I imagine this is not without controversy, because isn't it true when you restore a prairie, you take out other vegetation and trees? And I know there's a project that's happening. It's actually a federal project along the Minnesota River down where I live, and there's people who are wondering about them cutting down all of the trees as they try to restore some prairie. Is this pretty typical, or are you finding lands that are pretty barren already and then trying to get the right grass mixes in them as they restore it?
Madam Chair, removal of woody species and cutting of trees in the prairie section of the state of Minnesota is a common management technique. It does raise some questions about multiple use of public lands. Land that supports prairie species, such as gold-winged finches or pheasants, doesn't support deer and turkey well. And vice versa, land that supports deer and turkey well supports predators for gold-winged finches and pheasants. So it's sort of a Hobbesian choice. You've got to choose one or the other. And the general procedure is that in the prairie area to manage for the natural ecosystem, which is prairie.
I know it's controversial in some cases, and it is with the deer hunters more than anything, as the trees are getting cut down. Senator Ingebertson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and that certainly has been brought to my attention as well, and I think Bill did a good job of explaining that. And when we're out there trying to create habitat for pheasants and upland game birds, it's not real good for them to have trees where birds of prey can perch and watch them, quite frankly. That's what it's all about, that and the nesting. So those old dead trees and stuff that are being removed are for that reason. But, again, it's hard to find that balance between pheasant hunters, deer hunters, as well as the balance between fishermen and hunters. I mean, it's just a balance that you have to have. But I think if you'll notice over the history, again, there's been a pretty significant time and effort spent on that, trying to find a balance. And some years one area is going to get more money than the other area, and the next year it would catch up again. So,
Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Ingebretson, Mr. Becker, do you have areas in here where you're leveraging other funds, USDA, for example, National Research Conservation Service?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Becker.
Senator Magnus, we certainly do. I think that the highlight of the leverage is the RIM WRP project, and it's $13 million, I believe, that $14 million that's matched by an additional $1.60 for each dollar that's laid out by the state. This is a program that provides permanent easements on private land and then restores the wetlands that were drained. It's a significant program for restoring the prairie pothole region.
Senator Magnus.
Madam Chair, thank you. That's good. It looks like we're spending about $100 million here of state funds. I'm trying to get my arms around where everything else is and our total effort to do this, basically. The National Park and Fish and Wildlife, are they helping with invasive species and that sort of thing? Are they putting funds toward that, how do they support our state efforts? I'm trying to figure out the whole picture, Senator.
Senator Ingebertson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator. They have been just as of recent. I think you may have noticed in the media that the federal legislators, delegates have come on board now to help out with that, and there's an ask of $50 million to help with just those very projects you're talking about. So they are stepping up. How long that's going to be before we see those funds, I'm not sure, but that's certainly a good starting place. And I think they've been monitoring. Our federal legislators obviously come home and they hear what's going on, and they're very concerned as well. So they are actually stepping up and helping out a lot
Good. Madam Chair, another question here. How about the local or private entities like Pheasants Forever and Ducks Unlimited and so on? Are they helping out too when we put some money in, or are we just supplanting their money? Are they going somewhere else in another state when, you know, if we're putting in $100 million into our programs here? How are they doing?
Certainly, Madam Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
They're certainly partners. I mean, we deal a lot with Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Deer Hunters Association, which take in a large group of people in the state of Minnesota, and they have a lot of projects that we work hand-in-hand with them on. They will actually help them purchase those projects. They will manage them for a while, and in some years, you know, after that, they'll probably turn them over to the state of Minnesota. So they're very good partners for obvious reasons. That's what they want to spend their money on, and that's habitat and restoration of projects. No, they're very good partners. Getting just one more, if I could, Madam Chair, with regards to the federal program. As you know, Senator, being in the ag community, that the Farm Bill is going to be, folks are very concerned, those very entities are concerned, Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, we all should be concerned about the amount of ag production land that's now going to come out of the programs because of the cost of soybean and corn. I mean, the crop is going up, and it's going to be more financially better, of course, for the farmer to put that back into production. And that's going to be a struggle. That's going to be a real struggle for our habitat. And that's why it's important to put these RIM dollars in here.
Right.
And
Senator Ingebrigtsen, that's a good point because, you know, we're kind of caught in a squeeze where we have federal deficits, and you know, the money is just not there to go around everywhere that they're looking for. And as they look at trying to do cuts to the drastic cuts, frankly, to the agriculture budget and the wildlife management budgets, we are going to see changes in the way things have been going. And that combined with world demand up for food. So we have some challenges in front of us. So I'm pleased to hear, Senator, that you're doing a good job. You and the folks are doing a good job with this, and you're partnering up with a lot of entities here, both private and national organizations and public other public sources, and I think that's a good way for us to work as a state, to leverage funds from everywhere we can, and resources are scarce, and I think you're doing a very good job with this.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I see that you do have partnerships with a lot of organizations, whether it's Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Minnesota Deer Hunters, you know, various local units of government, Anoka County, that sort of thing. Which do some of them also make contributions to these projects then? Is there a match?
I'll let Mr. Becker address that.
Madam Chair, the Conservation Partners Program, which is the grant program to local units of government and private organizations, requires a match. It's a 10% match. The total private match in the bill is about $3 million, plus whatever comes in to the Conservation Partners match, which should be in excess of another $500,000.
Another question. I just have a question about this moose habitat. It says to restore and enhance public forest lands for moose habitat purposes. What do they do to develop good moose habitat, Mr. Becker?
Madam Chair, like much of conservation, this is vegetative management, and getting the right successional vegetation, the right stage of vegetation, I should say, to support the moose habitat in the right density. Browse is necessary and winter cover and things of that sort. This is a program that's a combination of the deer hunters, the counties in the area, in the northeast Minnesota, and tribes in the area.
One more question. Do you know approximately how many acres you're estimated to purchase with this $99 million appropriation? And what about the PILT dollars that might be needed to support that?
Madam Chair, yes, we do have that in the handout on page 1 in table 2. We're going to protect and fee 7,391 acres if these projects are all successful in their objectives, and protect and easement 11,744 acres. The fee would be where the PILT was generated. And if you turn to page 3 and take a look at table 6, you can see that there are 3,223 acres that will require PILT payments. The amount of payments is second to the bottom row. It'll increase our annual PILT payments by $87,215, an estimated amount, of course. You can see by looking at the cells to the left of the 87,000 that this is the lowest PILT contribution we've had in the history of our recommendations, owing largely to Crow Wing County's willingness to forego PILT by taking on the Upper Mississippi Northwoods project that Senator Ingebretson spoke about earlier in his presentation.
Senator Ingebretson, is the PILT dollars are usually in the tax bill, isn't that correct? So when you take on these responsibilities of purchasing these lands, we're not considering it the responsibility of the Outdoor Heritage Fund to pay the PILT?
Madam Chair, that was a question that was answered the very first year that we had this program, and that was a determination or a letter from the an opinion from the Attorney General's office, because that has been a discussion every year. Every year we hear about PILT payment and our PILT obligation, and so that question was asked. We thought it was certainly a good way to do that, to go ahead and pay the PILT payments out of here as well, PILT obligation. But the Attorney General's office ruled that that is unconstitutional, so we can't do that. Now, you should also know that the projected PILT payments over the whole 25-year program is going to amount to approximately, now this is approximate numbers, of $5 million a year. Right now, I think before the Outdoor Heritage Program even started, I think the state of Minnesota had about a $20 million or $22 million obligation on PILT total. So
it's getting up there. I don't know that I agree with the Attorney General's position on that, because it seems like if you create the cost, that it should probably be paid for out of the same fund that creates it. But I guess there's nothing we can do about it right now.
Madam Chair, and again, those discussions have been going on, as Bill can attest to, and those that deal with the bills for years go on. The consideration of PILT is an issue. It used to be paid out of the DNR budget, is now coming out of the tax budget. The way I understand is how it's doing it. What folks don't understand is that if we purchase land for the University of Minnesota, there's no taxes paid on that. There's no obligation there. So other lands and other properties owned by the state of Minnesota don't even pay for their taxes. So hunting and fishing, by statute some years ago, hunting and fishing lands were required to do that, recreation lands. So that's kind of an interesting that everybody would bring that up, but they need to know that there's an awful lot of land that the state owns where there's no PILT being paid. So,
Senator Bonna?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebretson, can you just share why the Attorney General, what was the rationale for thinking that? Because it doesn't seem to make sense.
Mr. Becker?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonna, the Attorney General's letter went through what PILT is used for, and it's used for police services. It's used for, in some cases, education, other local services, and took a look at those uses of PILT and looked at the Constitution and to what the Outdoor Heritage Fund could be used to do, and saw that there was a mismatch, that the Constitution didn't say you could use the Outdoor Heritage Fund for education or water treatment or things of that sort necessarily. So that was the basis of their analysis of the situation.
Well, Madam Senator Chair, Bonner, a follow-up. Then couldn't we, in legislation, do a carve-out of PILT that was a result of land that was purchased through this and say that that money had to be used for purposes that were associated with the Act itself?
Mr. Becker?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonner, that's been discussed, and I think the toothpaste tube analogy comes into play here. You carve out something for local parks paid out of this, and how do you make sure that the local budget doesn't, in essence, use that to supplant existing park expenditures and that sort of thing? But I would have to say that some pretty good minds have spent quite a bit of time thinking about this and been unable to come up with something that seems to suit everybody.
Hmm.
Not that you have to suit everybody, but that's been the history of it.
Senator Newman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In an attempt to maybe add to Senator Bonhoff's question a little bit, and Mr. Bodern might have a better idea on this than I, but an attorney general's opinion does carry some force of law, but it certainly ranks real low on the totem pole as to the enforcement of it. And my position would be is we as a legislature, we don't have to abide by what an attorney general's opinion is. We can enact whatever law that we want. The other thing that would be available is a court challenge. If you really wanted to pursue it, because a district court ruling carries more weight than an attorney general's opinion. So, but I Senator Bonhoff, I wouldn't if there's a carve out provision that you're interested in, I wouldn't even hesitate.
Thank you,
Madam, on that point,
Senator Olson,
Madam Chair, and Senator Newman, are you suggesting that the Attorney General's opinion be challenged in court, or are you suggesting that the legislature go ahead and act and see if anybody challenges it to determine whether it's not?
Senator Newman?
As a legislator, Senator Olson.
Could you talk into the mic?
I certainly can.
Thank you.
As a legislator, Senator Olson, rather than an attorney at this point in my career, I would opt for legislation. And you know, that's what our job is. And, you know, again, an attorney general's opinion is just that. It's an opinion. And that would in no way dissuade me from thinking that we have an absolute right to enact whatever legislation that we choose to.
Senator Olson?
Well, Madam Chair, I appreciate your identification of what state lands do and don't fall under this category, but the reality is that this PILT for the recreational and those lands has not been created because the legacy fund passed. It would be continuation of the current practice, and so it would seem to me that there could be some justification that adding to that land that it carries with an additional expense of the PILT. So,
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is the kind of discussion we're having all the time. It really is, and it's interesting, and some interesting points of view. But I guess, you know, part of the thing that I took from the Attorney General's ruling was that you were using tax dollars to spend on taxes, and that was problematic for them.
Yeah.
Now, one could argue that you know, that doesn't matter. It's still a project. We buy land and we pay for it. And when you talk about lawsuits, you know, in statute, that's exactly what we were talking about, was putting it in statute over the last, I think probably the first 2 years, we talked about putting that very thing in statute, and that's where we came up to the opinion as to the Attorney General saying we couldn't do it, and that pretty much put a stop to it, at least at that point. But I'd be certainly wide open to that. But if you're, you know, everybody has different opinions. Maybe we should be looking at the University of Minnesota and all the technical colleges out there that own properties. Maybe we should be doing some revenue coming from those lands and those properties. I mean, there will be people that will say we should do that as well then, instead of just hunting and fishing opportunities. So when you open that can, if you will, it'll come at you in many different ways. And you talk about lawsuit. We're always cognizant of that, of making sure that we stay, you know, within the boundaries of the Constitution when we spend these dollars, and make sure they're spent on the areas that are supposed to be. You should also know that in last year in the tax bill, we did put an amendment on. I believe maybe even Senator Bach might have added this with regards to PILT payment, and we're going to do. There is a PILT study going on right now to clarify for the legislature just what all lands are being required to pay PILT and the lands that aren't. So that's a real good start, because I know even PILT payment, Senator, you should know that once it's paid to the counties, not all the counties give townships their share. When I learned that, I started thinking, why is that happening? So that's part of the study as well, and that's supposed to be done, I think, in December or January this year. So,
are there any other questions about the bill? Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against it? If not, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair, members, I would move Senate File 2493 to be passed and sent to the floor.
On that motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. Senate File 2493.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With no amendments, right?
Thank you.
Will be placed on general orders. Thank you.
Morning, Senator Roebling.
Good morning.
Would you like to present Senate File 2121 to the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 2121 comes to us as a result of a recommendation made by the legislative auditor in a program evaluation that they did this year on fiscal notes. And one of the recommendations is that we would we as legislators would be able to request and have fiscal notes prepared early as we're planning something maybe significant, a new reform, new program, and that if we did that, we should have that remain private data. Mm. And it is kind of in the hope that it would encourage us as legislators to perhaps plan ahead and then be able to get a picture of what the cost might be for a proposal before we actually brought it out in public. And it may help us decide if we even want to bring it out in public, but people wouldn't even have to know or have that information until we either introduce the bill, or as I am proposing in this amendment, or we introduced an amendment that would have that information included in it. So it would be released with an amendment or with the introduction of a bill. And so, members, I would like to propose the A2 amendment. And basically what this does is simply say that the data could remain private until an amendment is proposed or the bill, so that it would allow them to release the data if that particular proposal with the fiscal note became part of a bill through an amendment. We already had it when the bill was introduced, but this just expands it to the amendment as well.
Okay, have all members had a chance to look at the amendment, the A2 amendment? Okay, Senator Roebling proposes the A2 amendment. All those, any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The amendment carries.
And so, members, the bill is really rather straightforward and simple. We're just enacting one of the recommendations from the legislative auditor's report into statute, and it hopefully will give comfort and encouragement to members to move forward with maybe some significant proposals, some significant changes in programming, and they know that this will remain private data because otherwise it wouldn't be. If we don't specifically signify this, it would be always public data. So I think it would be good for members to have this in place, and I think it might be good for all of those who prepare fiscal notes, because then maybe members will bring this to them sooner rather than later, and they'll have a little more time perhaps to prepare those notes as well. And I don't know if anyone from MMB is here. I think we do have someone. I don't know if they want. They helped us work on this as well.
Okay, Senator Higgins has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Roebling, what section of statute are we actually putting this in, the data privacy section, or is there a section that tells us how government works?
Senator Roebling?
I believe it's in the data privacy. We did go through the Judiciary Committee already.
Oh, bless you. It's always such a nice thing to do, isn't it? And then
Senator Higgins,
Mr. Chair, what the heck was my other question?
Well, Senator,
I can't remember.
Senator Bonoff has a question first. If you,
Mr. Chair, and just a comment, not a question. I very much like this. You know, as somebody who works on the reform and redesign area, a lot of times as we come up with ideas, then we find out, you know, right before it's going to be presented, oh my gosh, you know, it's way more expensive than we expected. And if we had that information earlier, we could rethink the way we were approaching the particular idea. So, for example, like, you know, I got somebody to give me a range of how much a big transportation study would be. And then when I heard how expensive it would be, I was able to go back and get advice about doing some sampling of looking at costs. So I was able to completely rethink the way I approached a pretty comprehensive problem based on getting early data. And yet you don't want to have that early data be public, because then there's always that, oh, this, you know, so-and-so was proposing to spend this, you know, huge amount, and that would keep somebody from going forward and working on something.
Yep.
That's right. That's why the recommendation came through, because they're trying to help us get fiscal notes that are meaningful and early enough, and have time so that the staff has time to actually develop them. And we just thought this might be encouragement to have legislators make that earlier request.
Senator Higgins.
I remembered my question. Will we be, or will you be also proposing to update the Senate rules so that there's a reference to the unofficial fiscal notes in there? So, I mean, a new person coming in would very highly unlikely to be reading the data privacy section of our statutes to find out about unofficial fiscal notes. And so maybe we need to update the rules so that it's there for people to know about.
Senator Roebling?
We can certainly look at that, Senator Higgins. I hadn't thought about that, but it would be a way to inform members.
Yeah, kind of makes some sense.
More questions? Anyone from the audience care to testify? Well, Senator Roebling, what's your desire with the bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that I would like to move to lay Senate 2121 on the table for today.
Right.
I plan to move it, but I just think that there may be something that we might want to consider further on it, so I'd just like to lay it on the table.
Okay, members and audience, Senator Roebling moves to lay Senate file 2121 on the table. On the table.
Thank you, members.
Judiciary Committee.
here late at night.
I don't want to be I better not do it. I better not.
We have a page looking for our next author. It is Senate File 2179 in your packet. And here he comes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I'd step out for a second next door to my office.
Senator Cruz, welcome. And if you would like to begin by explaining your bill.
I certainly would. Today before us, we have Senate File number 2179. Essentially what this is it's a bill granting legislative oversight to the Metropolitan Council budget and capital investment programs. So let me really quickly walk you through what this does. Essentially in Section 1, this clarifies that the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government must meet at least once per calendar year. The reason for this is recently we have seen a lack of this oversight commission meeting. As a matter of fact, up until this year, the commission hadn't met for the previous 3 years, so we felt that that was an important piece to add here. We do recommendations on the budget through the commission, so that would be just an automatic thing that they would meet annually to at least review the budget and the capital investment plan. Section number 2 requires that the commission to make its recommendations on the Metropolitan Council to the legislature by February 15th of each year. And then if you look in that section, the subjects of those recommendations are the same. They stay the same as we're currently in statute. Section 3 changes the council's budget year from the calendar year to fiscal year starting on July 1st. The Metropolitan Council must present a proposed budget to House and Senate committees that have jurisdiction over the council and to the Legislative Commission. The proposed budget must cover the council's proposed budget for the next year. The council cannot adopt a final budget until the legislature enacts a law authorizing the council's budget. If a budget is not enacted, the council may continue to operate and implement its previously approved budget. Section 4 goes on to require that the Met Council also submit its capital investment program. And then finally, Section 5 is kind of just a housekeeping thing. It helps to structure the transition between the current annual budget and the fiscal year budget. We had to kind of align some things there. So that's the meat of the legislation. I think it's important, you know, anytime we have a piece of legislation in front of us, to ask, well, why? Why is this important? My answer to that, broadly, if you look at the work that's been done by the Office of the Legislative Auditor and its recent assessment of the transit portion of our metropolitan government, and also the work that's been done this year by the Commission on Metropolitan Government, the recommendations have astoundingly been that there needs to be more oversight of the council. Very quickly here, I have both the Metropolitan Council's operating budget and capital investment plan. And to just give you a brief idea of some of the numbers that we're talking about here, as far as the capital improvement program, year over year, it's about it's $662 million. It's just for the 2012. If you take that out over the entire current capital investment plan, which spans from 2012 to 2017, you're basically talking about a $3.5 billion capital investment plan. So we are talking about a very, very significant amount of money here that I would argue has long-reaching impact as far as if you invest in, say, things like light rail. It has the potential, not only, it doesn't just affect the region, but it also affects state assets and monies that could be tied up there. Moving on to the operating budget, very similarly, we're talking about some significant numbers. Year over year right now, we're talking about $500 million operating budget, annual operating budget. Now, just to let you know, year over year, that over the last 2 years has gone up 4.5%, right around 4.5%. And I think it's important that when you compare that to some of the things that we've had to do here at the state legislature to control our spending, to get our operating budgets in order, and then to see that this has grown at a 4.5%, I think that's kind of telling to the need for oversight. You know, is there some kind of disconnect here, especially with a council that has taxing authority? Is there some kind of disconnect between what's going on in the economic environment of the state and how they're handling their budget? And then lastly, I think it's important to also look at, to accentuate that, the number of FTEs. If you look at from 2009 to 2010, the total FTEs for the council went up by 43. And then even more, if you look at 2011 to the proposed 2012, that's gone up by 76 FTEs. So again, I bring us back to what we've had to do here at a state level, cutting back on, you know, I'm sure Senator Perry can attest, some of our, trying to control some of our FTEs at the state government level. You got to ask, well, why is this not happening at the regional level with this Metropolitan Council? Well, my argument would be that there is a significant lack of oversight. The Metropolitan Council is allowed to perform as the Metropolitan Planning Organization, which is the pass-through organization that allows us to get federal dollars, because it has the Transportation Advisory Board. So the argument has always been, well, there's the accountability because we have the elected officials on the Transportation Advisory Board. It's important to remember that this is just an advisory board. There is no real, what I would argue, real authority over the council. The advisory board is kind of given plans, and yes, they do get an up and down vote on that. But essentially, it's coming from the council down, the top down. I think we need to, as a legislature, provide that higher oversight over them and simply just make sure that we're heading in the right direction there. So with that, Madam Chair and members, I will stand for some questions. That's the bill and the necessity in a nutshell.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, it seems to me that I don't know why this got referred just right to finance, but it seems to me that there's some pretty far-reaching implications with regard to transportation and transit planning. And so I don't think that the referral was the right referral. I would move to send this bill directly to transportation because I think that that they should have a chance to look at the implications of their planning process as it relates to current projects.
Well, Senator Cruz?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, I'm obviously at the will of the committee, whatever the direction the committee would like to send this. I am not currently aware that Chair Gimsey has asked to see this legislation in front of them. That doesn't necessarily mean that it wouldn't be appropriate. Again, I'll leave that up to the chair and the members of this committee. I will let you know that this is not the first committee that it has been to. It has gone through local government as well. So, and essentially, that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about oversight. So,
well, members, I don't know that. This is really pretty much a policy decision as to whether or not the legislature should have approval over the budget. It isn't deciding on their budget at this point. It's a policy decision as to whether or not they should go from a calendar year to a fiscal year, and also if before they get their budget approved, if we as a legislative body should be able to review it and then give it approval, probably very much like we just did with Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill. They have a body, well, that does include some legislators, but mainly non-elected people who serve as an advisory council to us, but we actually have the final authority over the expenditure. And so it doesn't have to do with an actual budget at this point. It's only the budgeting process.
Well,
Senator Bonoff?
Madam Chair, I would disagree because much of what ends up in the transportation budget bill does have to do with metro transit planning, and that does work in coordination. So I think in terms of the process that we want to be careful that we don't have the overall legislature deciding on a budget before the pieces have been able to be examined and testimony heard and implications understood. I think probably the Met Council who's here would like to address that. That is the concern, that the whole body is not prepared with enough information and testimony to be able to approve a budget until we make certain it's gone through its proper channels.
And I, Senator Boniff, I agree that it needs to go through proper channels, but I think that budget on an annual basis, or I don't know if they'd go to a biennial budget, I think they do an annual budget at this point, that it probably would have to go through transportation and some other areas of the legislative bodies before it went to the floor, certainly. So the budget itself would still move through various entities that had probably more expertise in certain areas of their budget. But it is, I think it really is the process only that we're talking about today. And once it came here for approval, it would go through, I believe, the appropriate chairs, appropriate committees to be reviewed. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Senator Boniff, I'm not sure whether you sit on a transportation committee or not. I don't.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I did for 4 years. I don't this right now.
Madam Chair, I'm just listening to Senator Cruz's presentation and the amount of people that have been hired over the last 2 years when we've been basically stopping all hiring and freezing hiring here at the state level. That raises a question, and I don't know if this is the appropriate place to do that, whether that's being taken up in transportation or not, but that's certainly, I would like to know why those people are, you know, why the amount of folks, what projects precipitates that kind of growth in an entity that we're funding. A lot of our funds are going there.
And I think we do have some answers for that. We have Chair Hay from the Metro Council is here, as well as Judge Chetnan.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Bana.
There is a motion before us. I would like to hear from them, but I did move to send it to transportation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senators. I'm Sue Haig. I'm the chair of the Metropolitan Council, and I also have Judge Chetnan up here with me, who is our government relations person. And I want to just talk about a couple of our responses to this legislation. First of all, we have a requirement for oversight by the Legislative Commission, and we do not oppose the Legislative Commission's review of our work. That's been a process that we've had in place for a long time, and we certainly accept that. This particular bill, though, really does not fit with the way the budget process works for us at the Council, and maybe it'd be helpful if I could describe it. The Metropolitan Council is a political subdivision of the state of Minnesota. Our budget process and our budget year is like a city and like a county. So we budget on a calendar year basis. Only 10% of the funds for the council budget actually come from the state general fund in our operating budget. And those are really funds for our transit system, Metro Transit. The vast majority of funds in the council budget come from user fees. Those are fees for fares through our transit system, as well as our sewer access charges to run the wastewater treatment system. The other primary source of revenue that we have is a local property tax. Our property tax is limited by levy limits, as it is for cities and counties, so there is that oversight for our budget process. We go through the same process that cities and counties do for establishing our budget. We go through truth and taxation. We have public hearings. We have public meetings. Our meetings are televised. It's a very transparent process. This particular bill would put us in a situation where you would have the Transportation Committee making decisions about the State General Fund appropriation for the budget, and you would take us off cycle with cities and counties. When we make grant funds available to cities and counties through Livable Communities Act grants or through our parks grants. Those are all entities that work on a calendar year basis. So our strong, strong preference would be to continue to maintain the council budget as a calendar year budget. We have no problem if you want to increase a requirement for the Metropolitan Commission on oversight to meet on an annual basis. I think that's, you know, perfectly fine and appropriate. But we would really object to the legislature, in essence, adopting the whole Metropolitan Council budget, taking over that responsibility from the council. And in terms of accountability, the governor makes appointments to the Met Council today. You're right, we're not elected. We are appointed. These members of the council, as do I, have to be confirmed by the by the Senate. We serve at the pleasure of the governor, so that's where our accountability comes from. And in reality today, as you look at our current appointees to the Met Council, many of them have served as city council members, planning commission members, former legislators, people with deep ties to local communities and deep experience in both local government and state government, and really bring that perspective to budget setting. I also wanted to respond to the questions that were raised about the number of employees. You know that one of the biggest projects that we're working on today is the Central Corridor construction project. We have many, many people employed with that project. That is one of the reasons we have additional employees on staff to do that project. I'd be happy to spend more time with the committee if you'd like to go over the budget in detail, explain some of the background on the budget. But we do not think this adds to accountability or transparency, and would actually be very confusing for us as we're trying to put our budgets together. We still must come to the Transportation Committee in the same way that any other state agency would come to get approval for their state budget appropriation. We go through a regular process, as do all other state agencies in that instance. And so this would just, you know, really create a completely different cycle of review and really change the fundamental responsibility of the council.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, I do renew my motion to move this bill to transportation. And actually, I sat on transportation for 5 years, and I do remember the many, many hearings that we went through how we were spending the state dollars as well as taxpayer dollars on the Met Council projects, and so therefore I do renew my motion.
Well, Senator Bonner, I rather intended to have a hearing in the Finance Committee, and so after we have that discussion, the motion to approve or and send it somewhere else, you could amend that at that time so that it would not be sent to general orders, but to transportation. I think that might be the more appropriate way to do it. It would be going, you know, in a different direction then instead of to general orders. Senator Olson?
Yeah, well, I think to that point, we went around that on another issue in another committee, whether you can just make a motion to send it to a committee without recommending it to something, either without recommendation or it's got to be a different motion. But may I just ask another question before take that up? Chair Hague, I would appreciate knowing what percentage of your tax capacity you use in terms of the property tax source of your budget.
Are we to our levy limit on our property tax? I have my chief financial officer over here, and she may be able to tell us. The property tax levy for our budget is about 10% of the overall budget, so it's about seven.
Yeah, that doesn't answer my question. I want to know what percent of it is. You are granted by statute a percent of tax capacity. That is your levy authority. What percent of that do you use?
Chair Hague,
It looks like I would prefer to get that information for you. Our statutory levy limits are actually only around a total about 23, 28, but looks about $33, $34 million. We're probably within a percent or two of those limits.
Okay, I would like some detail
Senator
on that.
We'd be happy to get you that information.
Mr. Shetland?
And Madam Chair and members, and again, the legislature has set the levy limits for the council. And if we were to come back, if we ever wanted to increase those, we would have to come back to the legislature in order to have those levy limits raised. And that is another part of oversight that that we undertake as part of the budget process. And regarding Senator Bonhoff's questions about the budget and through state funds that flow through the council, we go through a rigorous discussion with the legislature and with the administration every biennial budget as we produce those. We do that in the Transportation Committee. We do that in the Environment Committee. On our tax issues, we go through the tax committees. And those issues and those discussions are very robust. And what I have a concern about is how on line 2.13 on page 2, when it says the council cannot adopt a final budget until a law authorizing the council's budget is enacted, but in any year in which a law is not enacted to authorize the council's budget, the council may continue to operate and implement its previously approved budget, but at no greater level than previously authorized by the legislature. I don't understand how that works with the general fund. I don't know how that would work, especially when the council has to make a recommendation to the Oversight Commission by, I guess it's February 15th of each calendar year. And I guess I just don't understand that how that works when we go through a biennial budget. Do we have dueling budgets that we're working through with the parks? We also deal with constitutional funds, which are the motor vehicle sales tax. As Senator Ingebrigtsen just talked about, the legacy funds. We use clean water funds at the council. We also use regional parks funds. And the other issue that we have is when you look at the context of our budget, as Senator Cruz has shown you, it is a significant budget, but a lot of that money is pass-through money that we provide to the opt-out transit providers. It's also money that we provide through the regional park implementing agencies, and those monies flow through. The other piece of our budget deals with federal funds, and those federal funds come through the council for a variety of projects. One of those is being the Housing and Redevelopment Authority. We are one of 11 regional or HRAs that operate through the metropolitan area. There are other 10 that are set up by other political subdivisions that are not being asked to come to the legislature to explain how those federal funds are going to flow through the council. I think that there is an inconsistency there, and we definitely have concerns about that. As Senator Cruz also mentioned, that the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government has not met for 3 years. The council has no authority to call that committee together. That is up to the legislature to do that. And in the handout I provided you, it speaks to the council, and it says that under subdivisions 4, it says the commission must meet as soon as practicable after members are appointed in each odd-numbered year. The Legislative Commission has not met for 3 years. However, we did send them our preliminary capital budget, our preliminary operating budget, and it was just until this year that they chose to meet. If they had chosen to meet, I think a lot of the issues that we are discussing today would have been addressed. You can see under Subdivision 8 that the Commission must monitor, review, make recommendations to the Council and the Legislature for the following calendar year on our tax rate dollar and amount for the property taxes. It talks about any increase in debt of the Metropolitan Council, the overall work and role of the Council's proposed operating and capital budgets, work program and capital improvement program, and the council's implementation of the operating and capital budgets. Members, this is covered through the Oversight Commission. If we are happy, and as Chair Hag mentioned, we are happy to come back and have those conversations, but again, we cannot will that commission to meet. But we do believe that as a political subdivision that are similar to counties and states, that we already have an additional piece that the legislature has by creating this Oversight Commission in order to review the council. That is unique to us only. We are treated differently already. We have major concerns about how this would work with the other implementing agencies and the transit providers, and also how it works with our HRA program. And I just think that this is not a good bill, and the council opposes it.
We have a number of senators with questions. Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe you can answer this, Senator Cruz. Would this bill then prevent what I guess some of us were very concerned about, the the way the dollars were handled and the commitment was made by the Met Council before we had federal funding for the light rail. I mean, that was, to me, was very a very serious move that we were told that the state was committed to a project without having actual authorization or knowing for in fact that federal dollars would be coming for the project. I guess that's just my question on that.
Senator Cruz?
Madam Chair and Senator Perry, I think you are right in that assessment that it would have possibly, I would say, prevented that. And I think that was what I was going to, where a lot of these dollars can, when we decide at the Metropolitan Council level to invest in some of these projects, can tie up state dollars and have other obligations that are applied to them. Could we as a legislature say no? Some will argue yes, some will argue no, but I would argue that it's very hard to say no when you've invested such a significant amount of money in some of these projects to see that not come to fruition. You know, that's a very, very difficult decision to make. And I think, you know, the testimony here has also pointed to the fact that it's projects like that where you kind of get that ball rolling and don't have the ability to stop that or the ability to take into consideration a more global picture of what's going on with the state economically, with the state as far as the budget is concerned. I think that it's a very good point. That points to the exact reason why we need this legislation. I would argue that if we as a legislature had oversight, we would have taken into consideration everything else that was going on in the state. And even if we wouldn't have said no to the project, maybe we would have said we'll have to hold on for a little while. As a state, we can't financially invest in this right now. And you look at those projects, and that's the reason why the significant growth in the FTEs, the significant growth in the budget. So the short answer to your question is yes, I believe that it would have prevented that.
Chair Hay.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Perry, the state had significant oversight over the development of Central Corridor, and Governor Pawlenty, during his administration and state bonding committees, that is where the oversight for that project lied, and there was extensive debate and discussion about the state role in that project. And I would remind all of the members of the committee that the state role on this very massive investment in infrastructure is only a 10% share. 30% comes from the city, from the county CTIB sales tax. Another 10% comes from the county rail authorities, and then the remaining 50% share comes from the federal government.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you missed my point. My point was is that my understanding and all the testimony I heard was that the Met Council committed the state of Minnesota to a project that might not have gotten federal funding, overstepping what many of us believe is your bounds. And that's my concern. I have talked about the lack of accountability. I have talked about the fact that legislators over the past years are so greatly interested in giving away their authority to agencies, to unelected officials. And my whole reason for looking at bills like this is because it's time that the legislature takes back the authority that they have given. It's time that our rules and our regulations are brought back into the control of those elected officials that were elected to handle that authority rather than to give it so rapidly away. It's time for that, and that was the essence of my question.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was I want to get back to where I started, and Mr. Stettinen carried it his response far beyond that. But you did make the case when you talk about all of the entities that you deal with in state government as to why there's a need for the oversight. I think you actually made a good case for why this bill is needed and why we need to take more seriously that oversight, because it isn't just one thing. You know, Senator Bonhoff is very interested in the transportation part, and that's one piece of it. But there's the housing. You go on and on with the planning and the whole thing, and nobody really has a handle on the whole picture. My initial question was on the property tax, and unless I haven't been on taxes for a while, unless you've managed to get that changed, your tax was based on the tax capacity, and tax capacity is value. So with the property values increasing, your ability to raise property taxes, you know, increases. And that's why I'm interested in, you know, what that pattern has been and what percentage of that capacity that you continue to, appropriate or to levy. But that's what I am concerned about. But there are issues around the Metropolitan Council that do need attention. I'm not suggesting that the functions that you have aren't important ones, but how they're carried out and where that authority rests and that coordination and oversight is needed.
Chair Haig.
Madam Chair, and I think I misunderstood your question. I think I understand it better now. The property tax increase for the last decade at the Met Council, and certainly that was, you know, through the predecessor, was roughly around 1% per year. That was the levy increase for property taxes at the Met Council. So very, very modest increase over the last decade.
And so, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
What relationship does that have to the tax capacity and the authority? That you're still avoiding telling me what it is that I wanted to know.
Oh, Madam Chair, I'm not avoiding. I just don't have the specific
dollars. I'll ask the question and not expecting a precise answer today. Mm-hmm. I'm just raising the issue and hope that I can get that information. Thank you.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, and I never did formally withdraw my motion because I do respect your desire to first have all this discussion and then at the end make a motion, so I accept that, and so I do withdraw my motion at this time. But just wanted to say a couple things. One is, it sounds like there really is a strong need to have this Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government take a far more active role. And I don't understand how you have this commission and it doesn't meet. And so if we have to put into law that it should meet, and, you know, once a year seems pretty weak, if you ask me. I don't see how you can do much of a job of oversight if you're, you know, only meeting once a year. So I guess I would like to know more about the makeup on that commission. And I think that Senator Cruz, as this bill, if it does go forward, I would ask you to flesh out your emphasis and your focus more on that particular section. I think that it was a very good point Senator Olson made, that it isn't just transportation, it's also environment and it's also taxes. So I think all of those jurisdictions should have some say as to the process by which the Met Council's budget gets approved, because I don't think that we want to do something unilaterally that circumvents the process that our committee structure is designed to accomplish. And then, just on the record, I think it's important to correct that I don't think Senator Perry's correct in saying that the Met Council committed to any project that the state didn't approve, because I don't find that to be the case, and I think that it should be at least challenge that statement, because that's a pretty strong statement. I hear that you want more oversight, and I'm with you, Senator Perry, but I don't think that's accurate, that the Met Council committed to something and put the state dollars at risk.
Senator Perry, in response.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess we'll argue on that, because I specifically remember in committee it being testified that dollars were committed for the light rail project before we had a commitment federal funding. The new one here, the
Central
Corridor, that's correct. So,
and you know, members, I recall when that Legislative Commission was established, and I was actually a member on the early commission, and then I was, and we met.
We did.
And then I was replaced by somebody else, and I don't know what happened to that committee. I was never the chair. It rotated between the House and the Senate because it was a commission of legislative members. And I think it was kind of reconstituted last year, or maybe there were always members named to it, but they truly did not meet for a number of years. I'm not sure why, if the chairs just simply didn't call meetings. But it was designed, and it was designed to have metro area legislators on, because we recognize that a lot of you rural folks aren't really that concerned about the Metro Council because it doesn't affect your constituency at all. And so that we were asking them to have more oversight over it. So I don't know. I think there is some more discussion to have about this bill. And I know that the people are coming in already for the Commerce Committee. So I am thinking that we should just lay the bill over for the time being and continue the discussion. We can ask Senator Gimsey if he wants to see the bill. But I think for right now we'll lay the bill over. So the bill is laid over. And with no other business before us for today, we will adjourn. But before I take that official action, I just want to tell you that I think that we're going to have a floor session on Friday, and I think we are going to schedule a Finance Committee meeting for Friday morning, probably at 9 o'clock. Okay. I think the floor session is going to be at 11. And so we would have committee at 9 o'clock before that on Friday morning. But with that, this meeting is adjourned.
You have the agenda?